If you're craving that freedom that entrepreneurship gives you, don't take any money, right? Bootstrap, do it yourself, and then you will genuinely have that freedom. But if you have to, take it from people who are going to be most aligned with you in the long term.
Hey, welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This is the podcast for you if you want to understand the secrets and systems world-class founders use to build their business, their body, and their brain. I've got a massive announcement to share with you today. If you're watching on YouTube, you can already see we have a brand new studio. Our new Entrepreneur Experiment studio is the private cinema located at the Greenway from Iconic Offices. It is a beautiful venue. You can even hear it in the sound. Feel how rich that is. It's a beautiful private cinema located right in the heart of Stevens Green. So thank you to Iconic Offices for being an incredible partner. Today, I'm talking to Eamon Fitzgerald, the founder of Winespark. He's turned his passion into his dream life and dream career. There's not many entrepreneurs that can truly say that. Eamon is nuts about wine. He lives it, he breathes it, and he's managed to turn this into a beautiful business called Winespark. We hear about how he went to the UK, partnered up with Naked Wines to become their MD, before spending 10 years there learning the intricacies of the business before coming home and setting up Winespark. This is a beautiful story about passion and about following your dreams. Here is my chat with Eamon Fitzgerald, the founder of Winespark. If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from Iconic Offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of Iconic Offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Iconic Offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials from my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day. Bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Iconic Offices.
Eamon, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
You are our first guest in our brand new home.
Well, it feels nice to be here.
It's good, isn't it? We did a live pod here a couple of weeks ago, and now we're back. We've moved permanently into the Iconic Cinema. So welcome. You're our very first guest. You're our debut guest in the new home.
No pressure then.
No pressure. We'll make it a good one. Eamon, you are about to disprove a lot of theories people have because you are turning your passion into your business. What do you do?
Yeah, so I make great wine accessible and affordable to Irish wine drinkers. Started a company called Winespark 2 years ago. And in that time, we've grown to over 1,000 members. And we've got to 2 years in the last couple of weeks and still alive. So
that's a big landmark.
Feels like an achievement.
We chatted about that over coffee. 2 years is an achievement. 1 year is always the one people talk about. But 2 years... if you're in business, 2 years is the one where you're like, oh, that little breath goes out and you realize you've kind of got over that big hurdle. What did it feel like?
Yeah, it's a bit like that difficult second album, because in year one, you know, you get great press, you're new, you're exciting, friends and family pile on, and, you know, you win awards and all that stuff seems to come kind of easy. And you almost start to believe your own bullshit, that you might be quite good at this. And then year two hits and a lot of that stuff dries up and you need to really kind of knuckle down and start to prove out the business. So yeah, to reach year two feels like an achievement, and I feel like we're very well placed to succeed in year three and beyond.
I think that's a big self-awareness piece, because people actually don't talk about that, because people, I think, do believe their own bullshit after year one, because, you know, there's that energy, there's that enthusiasm, there's a little bit of hype around you. And there's a narrative. We've talked a lot already this morning about narrative. There's a strong narrative. Oh, he's starting a new business. Oh, he's starting a new business. It's a startup. It's a hot new thing. Year two is often the one that people don't be self-aware enough about, and they don't actually realize what happened in year one isn't going to be the same in year two. And, you know, you're not the hot young thing anymore. So how have you kind of changed your thinking about that?
I think a big part of it is actually maintaining your thinking and having that strong conviction that what you're doing is actually going to work and is actually, you know, in my case, I make great wines accessible and affordable. You know, I strongly believe that I'm the best person in Ireland to do that. And, you know, I've got a lot of happy customers who seem to back that up. So you've got to believe, you've got to have that strong conviction that, you know, what you're doing is the right thing. And that, you know, that passion and that conviction will carry you through some of the tougher times.
And when you say accessible and affordable, how does it work? What does WineSpark do?
Yeah, so even before WineSpark, I spent 10 years in the UK running a big wine business over there called Naked Wines. And I started there as the wine manager, grew to managing director, ended up a global wine director. And over that time, developed amazing contacts all over the wine world, all these great winemakers, managed a business of, you know, grew it from 20,000 customers to 300,000 customers,
wow.
150 people, you know, just big numbers in the end. So got great experience, you know, learning the wine industry and learning how to run my own business. And really got back to Ireland in 2019, just before COVID. And first thing I noticed was, wow, wine is quite expensive here in this country. And yeah, then during COVID, lockdown happened, the travel stopped, and suddenly I was stuck at home, you know, working on Zoom like everyone else. And, you know, as we kind of headed out of that first phase one, you know, back in May 2020, I think it was, you know, kind of, we're all stuck in a 5 kilometer radius of, couldn't leave our 5K. So we started doing drinks on our street every Friday night, like a lot of neighborhoods up and down the country. And because all the wine was coming to me rather than me traveling around, I started doing wine tastings on the street with our neighbors. And, you know, as I was pouring these great wines for people, I realized two things. One is I love sharing great wines with people. And two, you know, wine shouldn't be so expensive and intimidating to regular people. And I knew that with all my contacts down the years and maybe a smart business model, I could, you know, make these great wines more accessible, more affordable.
So you didn't come back from the UK with this in mind?
Not at all.
What brought you home?
Kids, family. You know, we'd spent 10 years over there, my wife Ruth, and we had two kids at the time, and decided to come home. Like I think a lot of people do at the time, had a great time in the UK and made great memories and friends, but felt like it was time to come home.
Because, were you still working in the UK job? Were you going to commute back and over? Or what was the plan?
I was still working the UK job. You know, a year before lockdown, I became global wine director. So I stopped being managing director because obviously I wasn't in person anymore. So global wine director, I was gone kind of 2 weeks in four.
Wow.
South Africa to the USA to Argentina to Australia, all these great places, traveling everywhere. But, you know, in hindsight, it wasn't sustainable, especially with a young family. And I'd hit 10 years, which is a kind of natural time to maybe start reflecting on things, going, what is the next step? And I figured, you know, in a wine market, which I felt, you know, certainly on the premium end, people were underserved. You know, the choice was intimidating and big. Prices were high. You know, something, maybe I could do something about it. So I never had that real entrepreneurial itch before that point. I just felt like I saw a big gaping opportunity to do something about it. And
I think that's a really interesting insight, because a lot of people are like, oh, I'm not an entrepreneur. Oh, I'm, you know, people either build themselves as, oh, I was born like this, I'm definitely going to be an entrepreneur, or, oh no, it's not me. And then it really is everybody though. I think it is the yawning gap. People are like, oh, when's the right time? I'm like, you'll know though.
Yeah.
Because it's the people like you who are like, I just could not do it.
Yeah, I wasn't that kid, you know, selling you know, sweets out of the locker in school. I didn't have entrepreneurship in my family, but I got amazing experience kind of in my career from a young age, exposed to people who bigged me up and encouraged me. And, like, you know, age 36, I felt like the time was right to kind of take the plunge and go it alone.
And Naked Wines, did you go in there because you're passionate about wines, or how did you end up in that job?
Yeah, so, I mean, the wine passion kind of starts quite early on when I was like a teenager. You know, we'd go on holidays to France with the family and, you know, drive over in the ferry like you're about to do on your holidays. And yeah, Dad would pack up the boot with wine on the way home, and we'd be sitting on wine like child shaped wine boxes, you know, and you know, trying to fit as much wine as possible into every cubic centimeter in the car. And I remember just bringing that wine home and opening the bottles and, you know, looking at the label and seeing names like Saint-Emilion and Gigondas and Chateauneuf-du-Pape, and then I'd look at the wine books and find them on the map and learn a little bit about them.
What a random hobby for a teenager.
It was strange young to get into that, but I just loved the idea. I love France. I love speaking French and all that stuff. And yeah, I guess that the wine bug bit then. And yeah, then I had a wine job in college. I worked for Accenture then, coming out of college, did the graduate program, and just to get some kind of proper professional experience first. And started a graduate program in 2007, just before everything went tits up with the economy. But I remember early on, started with an intake of 40 or 50 people, everyone super smart, everyone came out of good college degrees and stuff. And you're trying to find an edge, you're trying to find, where you can improve. And actually, we go out for dinners, like team dinners in nice restaurants. And people kind of vaguely knew I was into wine. I had this little wine blog on the side where I'd write about stuff. And, when the wine list was handed, usually to the most senior looking person at the table, a senior executive or whoever, like, they'd freeze, because who likes getting handed the wine list in front of a group? Mm-hmm. And it would just be, someone would go, "Oh, Eamon likes his wine." So like straight away, it's handed to me. And so I just realized right off, I've got maybe not a superpower, but something, I've got something I can stand out with here. And
the edge though, that's the thing. The that's entrepreneurship and being a founder, it often comes down to the edge, especially in your career, no matter what you're doing. And it's often not the thing you've done in college. People think, "Oh, just go to a good college."
Yeah.
Yeah, but everyone's coming out of a degree nowadays.
Yeah.
Most people are coming out of a master's. So where is the edge? And often it's in your passion.
Exactly.
It's in your, what is that thing you just would do for free? You're doing it already. You're blogging about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were doing it anyway.
Exactly.
So what was the next step then for you after Accenture? Did you go, "Right, now it's time to follow the passion," or how did you get into Naked Wines?
Yeah, so I moved over to the UK with Accenture, got a project with a bank over there, and took out a subscription with a small startup company called Naked Wines at the time, and went along to a tasting. I wrote up a review of the tasting on the blog afterwards. And then, a couple of days later, I got an email from a guy called Rowan Gormley, who's the founder of Naked Wines at the time, and said, "Hey, I love what you wrote there. Do you want to meet for a beer?" And
ironic.
Met him for a beer or two a few days later. And 4 months later, I was working with him, working for him up in Norwich.
So that's class.
He convinced me.
That is class.
Yeah, over the space of like about 2 pints to go work for him. And at this point, Naked, we're 2 years in. Became what my title was, a wine development manager, which is essentially, we've got this insane growth. We don't have enough wine to keep up with growth. Can you get on a plane and fly to anywhere that makes wine, find some talented winemakers, and bring some wine back home with
what
you?
What age were you?
I was 25 at the time.
What did you think when he offered you that job?
I first said, "Let me think about it," because
very mature.
I was living in London at the time, and I was, living the dream, going to theatres at the weekend and, out on the piss with my mates. And, he was trying to tempt me to come up to Norwich. So I did the London to Norwich commute. It's only about 2 hours in the train. Did that a couple of times a week, spent a couple of times up there. And every few months he'd email me. He's like, "When are you moving up here? When are you going to live here?" And I was like, "No, just still having fun down in London. And, I'll come back to you on that." And a year later, then he went off to the US to set up Naked Wines in California. And he promoted me to managing director.
Wow.
Because he obviously saw something in me.
What, 27?
Which I didn't see myself. And I accepted the offer. It was an email conversation. And he goes, "Oh, by the way, I presume you're moving to Norwich now." you got me there. I can't say no. And that was an amazing journey. Very, very quickly, taking the reins of a business that, we had about 30 people at the time, 20,000 customers, about £30 million turnover. Was tough at the start because thrown into it, no experience of managing a team, let alone
how did
a company.
You approach that? Let's go down to the micro. Oh, just I think what you did there is really interesting. I think the blogging and then the passion and the passion and then the opportunity comes. Mm. I think people often overthink it, going, "Oh, I really want to work in sport." Mm. And I often ask, "Well, what are you doing?" Mm. "Oh no, I just want to work in sport." I'm like, "Are you doing anything? You blogging? Are you creating a social media account?" "Oh no, I just want to work in sport." I'm like, that's never going to happen. It's never going to knock on your front door. I think it's what you did is just taking the steps, because you never know.
Yeah.
You never know what is the blog post or the podcast that just suddenly opens that door. How did you approach being promoted to managing director at 27? Like, what did you think? Talk me through how you actually handled that step up.
Pretty badly, I'd say. So you know, my comfort zone was, you know, being told to get on a plane to New Zealand, find an incredible winemaker making delicious Sauvignon Blanc or Pinot Gris and come back with it, you know, and I'd find a great winemaker, I'd write a brilliant story about it, and we'd sell loads of wine and build a relationship that way. That's lasted for years. And I think I made the same mistake that a lot of people do when they go into a big job or succeed someone, you know, who was doing well before that. And bear in mind, Rowan, he set up three businesses for Richard Branson at Virgin before setting up Naked Wines. If you read Richard Branson's book, he'll say he used to get Rowan up on stage because he was so charismatic and entertaining, whereas Richard would be like sitting kind of down by the side because, you know, you knew Rowan was mad. So yeah, you're following this very charismatic, impressive, inspirational entrepreneur. So the first mistake I made was I tried to do the exact same thing, right? And I remember it kind of really came to a head. You know, I went down, you know, you do, you kind of get through. And but I was asked to speak at a marketing festival down in London. This is a few months into the job, and you know, it's a good experience. I'm a bit of an introvert, so public speaking like generally terrifies me. But you know, you throw yourself into these things and you get through them. But I remember speaking at this marketing festival about the story of the company and how had we grown to that point. And you know, I was about 7 minutes into a 15-minute talk in front of 500 people, and I looked down at someone in the front row, and they looked kind of bored, or they weren't listening. You know, they just looked distracted, whatever. And it threw me, and suddenly the mouth went dry. I started to stutter and I lost my train of thought and I froze in front of 500 people on stage was like horrific.
That's the nightmare. Like I do a lot of public speaking and teaching, and sometimes I do find my brain goes to that point where I'm like, imagine you just stop talking in front of these 50 people.
Yeah, yeah.
That happens. I've done hundreds and thousands of hours of it, and I still get that feeling. It's such a human feeling.
Yeah.
But you lived your nightmare.
Yeah, completely. So anyway, got the water, struggled through the last few minutes of the talk and got the hell off that stage. And I remember I was in the green room afterwards with one of my fellow speakers, and I, you know, had my hands as like I'd had a mare, you know, and he was trying to, you know, big me up and comfort me. And he's just like, I was like, that was terrible. And he's like, no, it was really good. Like, and especially the stuff when you're talking about the wine, like people love that, you know, people are really into it. And I'd obviously just caught someone who either wasn't into it or just looked away or whatever.
But in a room of 500 people,
yeah,
you're going to have 100 that are on their phone.
Yeah,
you're going to have 50 who are thinking about their dinner. You're going to have 50 who are like, oh, I wish I hadn't agreed to come to this.
Yeah.
You're going to have 50 who are utterly hanging on every word.
Yeah, completely.
You can just, like, you just can't cater to 500 people. It's impossible.
Yeah. No, for sure. And then I realized that, yeah, the bits that when I was talking about the wine and the winemakers and some of my trips and the stuff I discovered, it came so easy to me. Mm. The bits when I was talking about the funding and how we got started, even though I wasn't kind of there for the first 2 years. And yeah, they're the bits that maybe I was less confident speaking about. And I just realized that, you know, why don't I just focus on what I love and what I'm good at? And really be myself, and less so on the stuff that I'm, you know. And it's, you know, when you reflect on it, it's exhausting trying to be someone that you're not. Everyone does it, especially, you know, when they come into a new job or a new company. You know, you put on this facade and this character, which isn't you. And just I've learned that the more you're authentically you, which sometimes means I haven't a clue what's going on here, someone explain it to me, or you really double down on the stuff that you know you're good at, that can produce results. And I had to unfortunately go through that pretty tough experience to learn that. And you know, once I kind of hit that and realized, let's just be me and less of the other guy, you know, we took off. And
there's a huge lesson in that, though.
Massively, yeah.
It's so liberating, though, when you go, you're not trying to pretend to be someone else who knows all the answers, because no one really wants that. People want the authentic story. Yeah. They want the real you of, oh, I went to this vineyard and the car broke down and it was amazing though, and they only do 100 bottles. That's where the magic is, isn't it? Narrative. We talked about narrative already loads of times, but that's the narrative, isn't it? And you can't fake that, I don't think. But I think stepping into someone's shoes like you did, that's a very difficult challenge. That's why I was so curious to see how you did it. How soon did that realization drop?
Yes, I mean, it probably took that experience to realize it, and you know, that from then, yeah, you just being yourself was a real game changer. And yeah, ended up, you know, growing the, being part of the team that grew the business to 300,000 customers and 100 million turnover and, you know, 250 people. So it was an incredible experience. And I guess, you know,
was their model like WineStrike? Was it wine subscription or what was it?
It was a similar subscription model, but the way they did it was different. And I kind of knew, you know, I was able to take learnings from that business and, you know, take the good of it and the bad of it and maybe, you know, create something which I thought had the best of both worlds with WineSpark, which is what I've done.
What lessons did you take from Rowan, studying under him and learning under him? What were the kind of key things you took with you?
Lots. I think one of the key things I took from Rowan and probably applied to my own business is Rowan was great at creating a business scenario or a business model that suited all parties. So, you know, back when we started Naked in 2008, you know, the supermarkets dominated the wine industry. They still do to an extent. But the problem with the wine industry was there was always someone getting screwed. Okay. So if you're a customer, you bought, you know, wine down the supermarket, the quality is not great. If you bought it in a nice wine shop, you're overpaying. If you're a winemaker and you're working with the supermarket, they're going to hammer you on price. It's a pretty tough relationship. So no one really is winning. And Rowan is great at creating business models and scenarios. He did this with financial services back in the day. He did this with all these industries where everyone won. You know, Naked was a model where customers got better wine for their money. Winemakers got cash flow up front and, you know, paid on time and, you know, got to make and sell, you know, more premium wines. And everyone, and Naked stood in the middle, you know, making a good cut as well. So everyone won compared to the regular industry where 85% of wine is bought in the supermarket. It's, yeah, the quality isn't great. The prices are low. There's no real joy. You know, one of the big supermarkets put out a job a few years back for a wine director, you know, head of wine for this supermarket. And it was a 15-page job spec, you know, very technical. The word wine wasn't mentioned once. And that just illustrates, you know, what that industry
is. It's more logistics, is it, than actual wine?
Very technical, very logistics, very price driven. So not a lot of joy in it. So, you know, coming back here, I kind of realized, you know, I would want to aim at maybe a more premium market. No point, you know, starting a business trying to, you know, compete with supermarkets. Also wanted to do something a bit different to Naked. So I entered a more maybe premium end of the market. And it just so happened that they're vastly underserved, like I said, you know, the intimidating choice and very high prices because of high margins. So how could I create a business model that would suit everyone? You know, customers subscribe to WineSpark for €10 a month. They get the wines at a 10% markup rather than the usual high margins you get everywhere else. And our winemakers get to, you know, make delicious wines they're proud of and sell them to an audience who really appreciate what they do. So it's just very different to what like the general wine industry is. So yeah, I'd say there that's the biggest lesson I took from
I love that, the win-win model. Because I think it goes against, you do the old style of business was, oh, you know, it's elbows out, you know, for me to win, you have to lose, like that old model. I think in general, that style of business is dying off. But I like the fact it was win-win. You did something there that's quite contrarian in terms of you went after the upper level market straight away as a young business. Most people do the opposite and try, you know, if it's cheap, people give it a go. How did you come to that decision?
I think it was, again, back to being yourself and being authentic. I have no interest in going to Italy and importing 12 containers of cheap Pinot Grigio. You know, I'm not passionate about that sort of product. I don't think that gives people pleasure. You know, it gives certain people pleasure on a Friday night, but in terms of like being a memorable product that stands out, you know, there's no point doing it. So, and then this is the reality of if you want to compete at a lower price point, you got to hit volumes fast to make the margins work. And in a small country, you know, with much lower volumes, even than the UK, that's just a very hard thing to do. Yeah, it's an interesting stat. I said 85% of people buy wine in the supermarket in the UK. That number is 65% in Ireland. Okay, so it's a smaller market, but a much bigger chunk of the market buy outside of the supermarket, therefore online or, you know, wine shops or wine chains. So there is a market there that, you know, it's a premium market. The prices aren't necessarily premium. So our prices start from 15 euros a bottle. That 15 euro bottle would cost 25 in a normal wine shop. A 30 euro wine at WineSpark would cost 50 at a wine shop. So, you know, you're giving people significantly better quality and value, but not necessarily for, you know, nice wine shop prices. It's actually, you know, people get really good prices for what they're buying.
And you know exactly who your customer is. That's there's such a power in that, knowing exactly what your niche is. A lot of people try to serve every master. Hmm. They're trying to be all things to all people. Oh, we're the one-stop shop for wines. That was kind of internet version one, right? Oh, Amazon. Get any book you want in the world. Whereas I think clever business models like yours are emerging now whereby, nope, we are only for this subsection of a subsection. We're only for wine drinkers, and within wine drinkers, we're only for premium wine drinkers. I think there's a serious power in that.
Yeah,
but it's ballsy. It's not easy. Like, as a young company, the temptation is, I'll figure it out later.
Yeah.
How did you set up, right? Talk to me through, okay, you started wine tastings on the street. You kind of had the business model and template, I guess, from Naked. But how did you go about setting that up here in Ireland?
Mm. I think it goes back, first of all, to having that experience at a big company for 10 years. And a lot of people get into wine and these other passion projects where they're passionate about it, or they had a nice experience on holidays, or they want to buy a vineyard or something, you know? People don't realize the absolute hardest part about wine is selling it, you know? So working at a company for 10 years in the industry, doing every role from buying wine through to logistics, customer service, marketing, growth, you know, you can't buy that experience. You can't study that. It just becomes kind of ingrained in you. So when it came to starting the business, I had a very strong idea, you know, about, you know, what I wanted to do. That was, you know, make these great wines more accessible and more affordable. There was a bit of an iteration around the business model, you know, how I'd do that. And that's how I landed on the subscription.
How were you going to do it? What was the first? Give me the raw, because that's what I love to give people insights. People are sitting at home now going, I want to start my business, but I have absolutely no Scooby idea for the start.
Yeah.
What did you think it was going to be, and what did it become?
Yeah, version 1.0 of WineSpark was a long way from what it ended up being.
Give me the juice, because they're the bits that people are like, oh, he's got it all together. Of course he knew what he was going to do. 10 years in the business, how could he go wrong?
Yeah.
How did you go wrong?
I had this idea around creating like a bond where people would invest in it and get money back in wine as opposed to interest.
Oh, clever. I was only reading about bonds yesterday in the Financial Times. Yeah. Finally understand what a bond is.
Yeah, exactly. And be kind of a bit of crowdfunding and all that stuff. And
so complicated.
Quite complicated. You know, again, in Ireland, it's a small market. I had no name here. I struggled to kind of get traction on that.
And because the whiskey market's super popular here for that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in theory, you know, red wine aged in oak barrels, not dissimilar, you know, in terms of the aging potential, how it accumulates value with age, all that stuff.
I can see where your logic went, because you can't open a newspaper or open any kind of financial investment prospectus without seeing whiskey.
Yeah.
Whiskey, 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 whiskey. So exactly. Was that where your thinking was going?
Yeah, a little bit. And then, you know, I have a group of business friends who we meet regularly, and you know, lots of people are entrepreneurs or run businesses or, you know, going through starting and ending things. And one of the guys suggested a really good exercise, which was, because two of us were starting a business at the same time, and we did a presentation for about 15 minutes, a deck, kind of the pitch deck on the business. And we did a round the table afterwards, which was, give me one thing you loved about that idea and one thing you didn't like so much. And it's a really simple exercise. But
good exercise.
It's a really good one.
I run something similar. So we do a monthly meetup, and you kind of bring a challenge.
Yeah.
It's generally for people who are running businesses, but you bring a challenge and go, right, what's the one thing I'm trying to figure out? And you explain what you want the end goal to be, and you explain what you've tried. And then you sit to the side like you're not there. And the five or six other people explain what they understood it to be and how they would tackle it. And just by getting that perspective, you're then sitting there. You can add no more. They can ask some follow-up questions, but then once follow-up questions are done, you sit there and they discuss it like you're not there. I love those exercises because you become so wedded to an idea, I think. So what were the pros and cons? What did people say to you?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of tore up the business plan at that point. You know, got really good feedback.
Wow.
Yeah, in terms of, yeah, it just wasn't a goer.
Why not?
but you know, that Bond idea was just a load of rubbish in hindsight. But you know, got the idea around the subscription, and you know, there's a few other companies in other industries who do something similar. And you know, playing on the good feedback I got, which was, you are so passionate about wine, you really know your stuff, people would really trust your recommendations, mm-hmm. you understand the economics of making wine and selling wine. And then the less good stuff, which was the execution. So you know, I knew I had a lot of the advantages, but just needed a better kind of model and execution. And yeah, that kind of morphed into the model the way it is today. And yeah, having run a big wine business for 10 years, you understand how the logistics work. You need a warehouse, you need a website, you need good photography, you need a basic range covering Rioja to Australian Shiraz to New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. So a lot of that stuff is kind of in your head anyway. I think that the big thing then you need is customers. Right. And, you know, this was like, I left Naked in January. I ended up launching in July. So 6 months later, you know, I told Naked in November, what I was off to do. And, you know, I was the managing director at Naked for 10 years, for the guts of 10 years. I was also the person who signed off all the emails because I was the main person finding them around the world. So I'd been writing to 300,000 people for the best part of 10 years.
How did it work? There was like a newsletter that went out every week?
It was
a weekly
newsletter.
Okay.
Personal from Eamon Fitzgerald, the wine guy. And it was about whatever, the latest and greatest wine that I'd found. So I'd been writing these people for the guts of 10 years. So it was only right then when I was leaving to say, I'm off. Thanks for the support and the memories, you know, and kind of see you later kind of thing. And I just stuck in a PS at the end to say, oh, by the way, my new business is in Ireland. If you know anyone back there, you know, just love to hear from them, or you know, please keep in touch. And to that email, I got 5,000 individual responses.
What?
From people saying, thanks so much for all the memories and, you know, thanks for all the wines. And 1,500 people said, yeah, I've got a cousin in Limerick, or my best mate has just moved to Dublin. You know, here's their email address. You know, they love to, they're all saying we'd love to find the equivalent of Naked back in Ireland. Like, so I had a starting, you know, customer database of 1,500 people, which meant that, you know, from kind of May onwards, when I built the landing page pre-launch, where it's starting to collect email addresses, through to launch in July, it just meant that, you know, rather than day one switching on the website, nothing happens, which I think happens a lot.
I call it all the blank page problem.
Yeah.
You're sitting there and you're like, where do I even start?
Yeah.
And I think that is a beautiful hack.
It was, and I mean, I only threw in that PS last minute in the email, just, you know, and the support and the goodwill was heartwarming, you know, for people to go, genuinely, fair play to you, you know, you're living your dream, you're going to do your own thing. Some lovely stories from people where, you know, the wine had played such an important part in their lives, their last bottle with their partner during COVID before they passed away, you know, like some really like deep and meaningful stuff. But the overall nature was of goodwill and good wishes. And by the way, here's my friend who lives in Ireland and would love a new wine supplier.
But people are searching for that personal connection, I think, now, because, you know, in the modern world, there's a lot of disconnect between kind of media and people, and it's like the podcast, people create a bond because they're listening to you for maybe like 3-4 hours a week. They're reading your email every week for 10 years. They pretty much know you. They know a version of you anyway. There's that parasocial relationship going on whereby they feel like they're your friend. There's a huge part of that. And newsletters are all the rage now. Newsletters are one of the hottest topics in business right now. Emails back in. Like, who would have thought it 10 years ago when social was the thing, 5 years ago when social was taken over? Whereas email is still incredibly powerful. So there's a good insight there, I think, for businesses listening to go, that's a direct relationship to my customer. Because with social, hit and miss. They might see the story. They might not. They might get fed by the algorithm. They might not. Whereas email, it's going to their inbox. Fairly good chance to read it.
Absolutely. And you have the chance to be personal with them. I think the biggest mistake companies make with email is treating it as a corporate, a mass broadcast.
It's an advertisement,
you know, from a company.
You don't want that.
The most important thing I think of when I write an email is it's personal. And if you treat it as personal, if you, you know, write in my head to Gary, you know, who I'm looking at right now, telling him about my latest discovery, it ends up reading that way. rather than, you know, a big sale or a discount. You know, people just don't respond as much to that in the long run. You know, you'll get a quick hit of sales. So if you can write personally and authentically, you know, so my best emails that I write, you know, I do all of my sales, we generate all of our sales through email, right? Yeah, like you say, you know, out of fashion 10 years ago, email never really left because it's just an extension of communication, which, you know, goes back to the carrier pigeons. You know,
how did you learn to be a good writer? Because yeah, email makes sense, but it's like anything, it only makes sense if it's very good.
I think always liked English in school and read lots, still read lots, you know. Combine it's important to combine, I feel like, you know, read lots of business books but read a lot of fiction as well, because you just get that blend of languages. Same, yeah. What you put in comes out. Even stuff like reading, you know, people have a go at certain tabloids, but if you read The Sun, for example, not that I do it often, but like their English is amazing because they have a target market. It's simple, it's understandable. Mm. And, you know, if you just read lots of different sources, I think what you put in comes out. And then once you have that, you then need to go experience the things that you're writing about. So in my case, I'll travel somewhere, you know, I'll spend time with a winemaker, I'll learn about the region, I'll always have my notebook in my pocket, taking notes, learning, you know, writing things down. And, you know, some of my best emails, best performing emails are written on the plane on the way home from, you know, Madrid at 9 o'clock at night. And I've had the most amazing day in a wine region. I'm probably still half cut from the lunch and the wine I had, but I'm just, you know, my passion and my excitement is kind of peaked as I'm going home because I cannot wait to tell people about what I've just discovered.
That's magic. So you're a blend of kind of an explorer, a journalist, a writer, and a businessman, all blended together. And I think that's a beautiful insight. You need to experience the things you're writing about. Because I think online, there's this temptation to just hop on trends, whatever is kind of cool. Oh, I'll write about AI.
Yeah.
Yeah, grand. Like you said, you might get an initial hit, but that passion has to be there. So I think for businesses listening, you have to be passionate and you have to experience new things. I think there's a lot of regurgitation of content, a lot of regurgitation of stories. I think you going out there every week and every month and finding new adventures to write about, it comes true. That's fantastic.
I think it's like, you know, everyone's talking about AI at the moment, how it's going to take over the world and, you know, eliminate jobs and humans and stuff. And it may well do that, right? But, you know, only 3 years ago, we're all sitting on Zoom going, who needs face-to-face anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, we've got this, why are we wasting all this money traveling and going to meetings and stuff? And, you know, a couple of years later, you realize, no, we need human interaction and authenticity.
That's why we're sitting across from each other right now in a beautiful studio with lights and... That's what you need. There's very little that can replicate this. Yeah, Zoom gets the job done sometimes, but you still need that human interaction. I think AI is going to take over a lot of autonomous jobs, so a lot of stuff that should be automated anyway, but it doesn't get rid of humans. It frees humans up to do more higher value things. You cannot recreate M. Fitzgerald's journey to a vineyard from an airport in Spain and what you experienced, where did you stop, what did you do? You can't replicate that with AI.
Yeah, I was in Bierzo last year. It's this region north of Spain, in the north of Spain. And there's a young winemaker there called Cesar Marquez. And his uncle is a very famous winemaker. Anyone who knows their Spanish wine will know who it is, Raul Perez. He's Spain's most famous winemaker. Cesar is his nephew. And he's only 31, 32, young guy. And everyone knows Raul Perez. Cesar has made wine with him since he was a teenager, right? So Raul's wines are amazing. They cost kind of 25 quid up to a grand a bottle, right? Cesar, while Raul travels all over Spain making wines all over the place, Cesar's always back in the winery on the end of the phone to Raul going, he'd do this, do that, you know. And in 2015, then Cesar started his own winery, and I picked him up 2 years ago at a wine fair, and, you know, went out to visit him in Bierzo, and, you know, spending the day with him, traveling around the vineyards and, you know, learning about, you know, what makes the grapes special and the combination of the land and the wind and, you know, the terroir, as we say in wine. And then back in the winery, and we're tasted about 45 barrels with him. You know, real, this guy is hot property in terms of, like, he's the name on everyone's lips in Spain, but so humble, so generous with his time. He'd be asking me my opinion. He's like, has this got too much oak, or is this good enough for the top blend? You know, asking me, like, I have no place or no, like, he's not going to take my, you know, my opinion is whatever. He's brilliant at what he does. But his humility and his ambition, you know, to, and you start to learn that, like, the reason he started his own business was he didn't want to live in the shadow of his uncle. He loves his uncle, loves his family, but he wanted to make his own name for himself. And, you know, when you learn that, you know, here's an entrepreneur in his own right, mm-hmm. making incredible wines. And, you know, the fact that I got him before anyone else did, and you can only get his wines with WineSpark in Ireland at an amazing price as well. They're the little moments where you can only get that when you're with the person, yeah. you know, over several hours, learning their history, learning their motivations, and learning what makes their product taste incredible.
I think that's very interesting about his mindset there, because any of the great entrepreneurs or founders I've met, they have that growth mindset. They're just so curious. They listen a lot. They ask you questions, even if it's about the podcast or whatever. They're just curious to go, how does that work? Yeah. And what do you do with that? That's interesting. I've heard about this. They're just on that buzz of that mindset of curiosity. They're driven by curiosity and not ego.
That's like exactly
he could have a massive ego. He could have the biggest ego in the world. He could just take over, walk straight in, take over the family business, happy days, probably wouldn't have to work too much. But instead, he's out there grafting, creating his own path. And that's Completely. Tough because that shadow looms large, I'm sure, from his uncle. Like, that's huge.
Yeah. And so many of the producers I work with, they're entrepreneurs in their own right. They might have left the family business or gone from a different career into winemaking. They tend to make wine in, you know, wine vineyards and wine regions. They're beautiful, but they tend to be quite remote. Some of the best wines come from these very harsh, remote areas in the likes of Spain and Italy and France. So it's a hard life, but a rewarding one, knowing that they're making brilliant wines. And that curiosity is usually what sets them apart. You know, wine regions tend to be centuries old, and the locals made wine one way for all that time and still do for the most part today. But it's those people who've got the curiosity, who might have traveled to other places, who kind of take that feedback from their importers and their, you know, the people that come in and visit and do things just a little bit differently. You know, the results are in the product, and they usually have a great story to tell as well. And that's my role.
So you actively travel a lot then to go and find these kind of hidden gems. So how often are you away?
Yes, I'm happy to be very well connected, you know, down the years. I'm gone every kind of six weeks for a night or two. It's a great way to obviously experience and find new wines and stories, but also it's a great way just to, I don't know, keep the balance with your life. You know, there's nothing better, you know, than having a great day, you know, in a vineyard, waking up early the next morning, going for a walk around a sleepy Italian village or, you know, a busy Spanish city as it wakes up, and you're just experiencing it. And it's just, you're out of, you know, Dublin, out of the daily stuff. And then, you know, it's just that reset you need. And then you get back to the madness and the kids. And
there's a big power to that, I think, because I think a lot of us get disconnected from what we're doing because we've all these tech tools, because we can do a Zoom, because we don't really have to do that thing, the boots on the ground thing. I think there's a magic in that and a power to it, and it's probably what keeps you fresh.
It definitely does. And it keeps your ear to the ground as well in terms of what's new, what's hot, what's, you know, like you know, even take the basic economics of the wine industry, you know, in Bierzo, you know, you'd be this really exciting wine region, Northern Spain. Some of the most expensive bottles in Spain are coming from this place. The grape is called Mencia. It's like Pinot Noir, Burgundian style, kind of Northern Rhone as well. Wine's great. You know, you'd be talking to the producer there. And it's like, right, how much are the grapes here? Like on average, you know, in the valley, it's like €1 a kilogram, right? So on a bottle of wine, €1 a kilogram means about 70, 80 cents of actual wine in the bottle. So in terms of, you go to this steep slope where all the most expensive wines selling for hundreds, if not thousands of bottles, like how much are the grapes off this slope? It's like €2 a kilogram, which is about 150 worth of wine in the bottle. So it's like, you realize then that, you know, you're getting all this intelligence all the time, but you realize the gap between what people spend at the top end of the market versus what they actually cost to produce, that gap is marketing. Okay, and what I'm trying to do is reduce that gap.
Okay.
But you only learn and understand these things the more you kind of get out there and talk to people. And I guess back to your point around curiosity as well. So it kind of serves this purpose when you get out in the road like that.
So year two, what's kind of been landmarks you've kind of gone, ooh, that's a big one? As in when you were kind of sat back, because I think when you're in early in the journey, you kind of just the head down is grinding. Yeah. And you, but you seem like a very self-aware dude. So I'm kind of guessing there's moments where you just kind of took your head back and went, oh, that was a nice little one to hit.
Yeah. You're always, yeah. I mean, year two, you're looking for any wins because those wins seem to come easy in year one because you're new. We recently crossed the 100,000 bottles shipped marked.
Oof.
Which,
that's huge.
Felt like a big, big achievement, you know, 2 years on from standing outside my house in Dunleary with, you know, a little kid's table in front of me and pouring some kind of unlabeled bottles of wine from my neighbors. So yeah, 100,000 bottles of wine is, you know, when you as entrepreneurs, I think you can be quite self-critical and all that stuff. Yeah. You do need to step back from time to time and kind of maybe just go, right, that's pretty good. And then you move on to the next, raging fire. But, yeah.
It's important though, isn't it? I think entrepreneurs don't do that. I think it's just inbuilt in us to be like forward. I think it's fear. I think I've thought about this a lot as I've chatting to entrepreneurs, afraid to stop, afraid to kind of smell the roses because it could all go away in the morning. And it very well could, but it's trying to find that blend, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Again, very hard to, but yeah, you do learn, I guess, you know, in my last job as well, like you got to celebrate the wins when they come. And I feel like, as a founder, as an entrepreneur now, compared to, you know, when I was the MD of my previous company, it wasn't my business. Those wins just are so much harder to come by. They're much harder fought. Therefore, they are more satisfying.
And they're sweeter, right?
Yeah.
They're sweeter. What do you do to grow the business? Because obviously you had a good tailwind to start with, which is incredibly smart of getting the emails. What's kind of like your strategy for growing? Because I like to leave people kind of tangible things they can apply to their business. What tactics are working for you in terms of getting in front of customers?
Yeah. So word of mouth is huge for me. I always looked, you know, I had lots of data to play with back in the naked days. And, you know, I always looked at our cohort of highest value customers. And, you know, the people who spent the most, who order the most frequently, who stayed around the longest. And the one thing that they had in common was they were referred to the company by their friend. Okay, they didn't come through some deal or some discount off, you know, off an online ad. So that, you know, that's why I thought, well, you know, we're starting WineSpark. Let's build a company around word of mouth. Therefore, you'll have the best quality customers. And thankfully, that's what I've seen. The metrics look spectacular so far. That obviously, you know, the next question is, how do you do that? And, you know, again,
thanks.
having had that 10 years experience and, you know, I remember surveying customers back in the day, you know, our best customers on our NPS survey, the Net Promoter Score, you know, what are the things that our highest promoters love most about the company? Two things, very simply, wine and service. Okay. So product obviously needs to be good, and service delivery, customer service when things go wrong need to be spectacular. The interesting thing, it makes sense, but the interesting thing about that were they both need, the response to that survey, service was as important as wine. So, you know, people, it's the less glamorous side, next day delivery, it's free for members, really good customer service, less glamorous side of the business. But, you know, when things go wrong, you pick it up and people then tell their friends about you. So really getting the basics right. It doesn't sound the most complex, but, you know, having
good service is rare though. Like, yeah. This seems mad to say, but like, we're always like, I'm always looking for insights here in the pod, and like, good service. Like, when was I teach an entrepreneurship class in Trinity, and before I start, we talk about kind of like, you know, marketing, communications, you know, promotion, blah, 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 blah. And I go, okay, before we start, tell me about the last time you had incredible service. And generally, people are blank for like a good 30 seconds, and they're like, oh, there was this one, you know. Only one. Like, it's wild because day to day you're kind of used to this kind of okay service, but when you get it, damn, you're loyal.
Yeah,
you're loyal to that.
There's
place.
A great book called, I read it, Early Days of Naked, very formative in terms of my kind of management style, how I ran things around there, called If Disney Ran Your Hospital. And it's written,
definitely never heard of that one.
Yeah, it's very good. I don't even know if you can get it on Kindle. It's quite an old book, but the principles there's gold dust in them. So it was a hospital consultant in a private hospital over in the US who wanted to improve patient satisfaction. So he went to Disney Disney Resort to figure out how they did it. And the biggest learning he took away from it was Disney used to survey customers at the end of their stay to say, how much did you love the stay, rated out of 5 stars. And Disney noticed that customers who rated the experience 5 stars were twice as likely to rebook versus those who rated it 4 stars. Okay. And I, you know, at the time Naked, we asked our customers the same question, how was the service you received today from the agent? But we only rewarded our agents, our customer happiness team, as we called it at the time, based on 4 and 5 star service. So if they did a pretty good job, they'd get their bonus and their incentives. Our 5 star service rate at the time was 65%. Mm. So I said, well, what would happen if we changed the target from 5 stars only instead of 4 and 5? And we also looked, we also saw the retention numbers were doubled for people who received that 5 star service. So we changed the target from positive 4 and 5 just to 5 stars, and it shot up to 85% in 2 weeks. And the retention and the frequency pulled up as a result as well. So it created a culture of just, you know, just people going above and beyond for the customer, rather than these agents being traditionally the kind of bottom of the barrel in any company because they're just doing service. They became the frontline heroes of the company. And we just built an amazing company culture around brilliant service. And it was all based on that book that I read. So
that's a phenomenal insight.
Yeah.
The difference between 4 and 5 star service. There's a great phrase I love. Show me your incentives, I'll show you your outcome. I love that. So you just change the incentives of the customer service agents so that the default 5 star.
Yeah.
That's what we're going for.
That's the standard.
I talked to you about the pod. That's why we moved into the cinema. We want it to be world class. You know, if you aim for world class, even if you get 9/10 of the way there, you've gone a long way.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other things around, trying to get, you know, driving word of mouth, you know, press is important. You know, I'm a believer that you should be more targeted in your, you know, we've had some great articles in the Irish Times, in the Currency, in the Business Post. So rather than kind of just spraying and praying and putting it everywhere, really important that, you know, identify your target customers, what they read, what they listen to, where they hang out, and then who are the people already speaking to them? Because it's very hard yards trying to build that database. Yeah. You know, I got a kick at the start, but then trying to grow it organically yourself is hard yards. And then the third piece is LinkedIn. So my number one traffic source from social channels is LinkedIn.
I'm a massive fan of LinkedIn.
And, yeah.
It's a sleeper hit. Like exactly. We got 100,000 video plays last month on LinkedIn.
Wow. Yeah. That's great.
Bananas.
Yeah.
But like people go, oh, LinkedIn, it's so boring. Yeah. People have this thing about it. I hate it. Blah, blah, blah. It's incredibly powerful. And it's the only social media I use that has serious organic juice.
Massively. And again, back to the point of where your target listeners or customers hanging out, you know, spending most of their time online, it's probably going to be LinkedIn versus TikTok or, you know, depending on obviously the audience. But certainly wine drinkers tend to be professionals and, you know, LinkedIn is the place to do it. So posting regularly on that, again, just authentic, honest content, whether it's wine discoveries or business learnings, drives traffic to site and that turns into customers, which is great.
That's phenomenal. I think it's insights like that I absolutely love to get. What's kind of the next kind of 6 to 12? Going into year three now, what's your kind of goal? What are you looking to hit this year?
Yeah, so very much continuing to obviously improve the business, grow the range of wines. You know, whatever I do, I want to make sure that it doesn't impact on the overall customer experience and the member experience. So a lot of work to do, you know, growing the membership base, growing the wine range. And, you know, eventually, you know, I'd love to build a foothold in Ireland to allow myself to, you know, expand internationally. Getting ripped off buying premium wine isn't a uniquely Irish problem. It's a problem the world over. And, you know, you can buy great wine everywhere. It just so happens that places like Bordeaux and Burgundy have 200 years of, you know, marketing clout ahead of other places. Therefore, people are overpaying for premium wine everywhere. So it's a model that applies in Ireland just as much as it does in the UK and elsewhere. So the idea is to, grow it here, build it here, have a healthy, vibrant membership base here and potentially take it abroad from there. I won't be pushed into doing that, you know, ahead of time, you know, I'm lucky to have investors behind me who are suppliers, rather than traditional investors. And they
wait. What do you mean, suppliers? So how did you fund this business?
So I think back in day one, obviously needed a bit of money to get started. I did what everyone does, I think, which is dial up a few angel investors or VCs or people who've got a bit of cash. And yes, straight away, I kind of, you know, based on some of the conversations I had, I realized that the tone and the directions of some of the questions I was getting, like, you know, when are you going to, you know, how fast can you grow? And when are you going to supply restaurants? And when are you going to launch in the US? Like, one, a bit too fast. I hadn't even, like, I just barely put the business plan together. And two, totally at odds with, you know, what's best for the customer. There's a great quote by Sam Walton, who's founded Walmart, who said, there's only one boss in business, it's the customer, and he can fire everyone from the chairman down by taking their business elsewhere. And I think particularly in direct-to-consumer businesses, where if you've got, you know, investors behind you, you can end up working for the investor rather than the customer. And, you know, in my experience, you look after the customer, the investor will be fine. So, you know, very, very soon, you know, talking to some of the more traditional sources, I realized, you know, maybe this wouldn't be optimal for me or for the customer. And also the realization that, you know, I'd worked for someone for 10 years, and the minute you take someone else's money, you're working for someone again, right?
Huge insight, though. So many people think money will solve my problem, an investor will solve my problem. They'll know what to do. Once I get the money, all the problems go away. Very rarely has someone sat in front of me and said those things before. They've always said it after, going, if I knew now, if I knew then what I knew now, I'd never taken the money. Like, for you to be able to do that prior is probably the key differentiator between your business and why we're sitting here today.
Yeah. I mean, if you're craving that freedom that entrepreneurship gives you, don't take any money, right? Bootstrap. Do it yourself, and then you will genuinely have the freedom. If you have to raise money, which a lot of people do, try and raise it from the people that would be most aligned with the long-term outcome of your business, and that's either customers or it's your suppliers. Okay, and I looked at it going, I don't have a name in Ireland. I've worked in the UK for 10 years. No one knows who I am. I wouldn't have much traction from customers, I reckon. So the next best group was my suppliers, which are my winemakers. So I managed to cobble together 14 of some of the world's most respected winemakers. And this is just off the back of COVID. So they'd probably sold a lot of wine during that time because everyone's stuck at home. So had a bit of spare cash knocking about. So I raised 350K to get the business started. If you look at winemaker, you know, anywhere like Rioja, for example, you know, these people make investment decisions where they're buying a tank for their winery or a piece of land, you know, some vineyard. They're long-term decisions. They're often, you know, not trying to make a quick buck in 3 to 5 years time. It's to pass on to their kids or their family, right? And obviously, you know, we're aiming for a quicker turnaround than that. But, you know, they invested in WineSpark instead of, you know, buying a patch of land, for example.
But what a beautiful way to think about business.
Yeah.
Like, and we don't think about that, you know, thinking quarters, so we think in years. But what a beautiful way to think about your business, especially as a young entrepreneur, especially as someone starting out going, right, long term, what's the best strategy here and who is most aligned? What does the suppliers say when you rang them up? You're like, random one for you. Like, is this a done thing in the industry, or how did you even come up with this?
Yeah, I haven't. I mean, in terms of done thing, apparently it was a big thing back in the 80s in Japan, where like electronics manufacturers, car manufacturers would get their suppliers to invest. There's a Japanese term for it. I'm not sure what it is, but when suppliers invested in their end consumers as like a... It's just the ultimate alignment. So
yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, listen, when I picked up the phone to my winemakers, I was surprised and enthused at how excited they were about it. And I think that a lot of it was I'd helped them, a lot of them over the last 10 years, and helped them grow their business and all that stuff. So there was a little bit, it was nice to maybe for them to return that support and get it back in. And knowing me and knowing my track record, I think they had a lot of confidence that it would be a safe bet.
Comes back to that pedigree thing, doing your reps. So, yeah. People forget about it. A lot of it is just reps. Being consistent. I hate people who are like up one day, down the next, ring him today. Well, how are you getting on a grant? Ring him tomorrow. What do you want? Like, yeah. I hate that kind of like that short-termism whereby your pedigree was shown over 10 years so that when it came to the crunch, you had that juice, you're able to pull that power out.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they give me good prices and it's a route to market for them as well, for a lot of the people into Ireland. They give me great prices on the wines, which then I can obviously pass through to customers. Customers benefit, give me good payment terms again, which helps the cash flow. If I need a new winemaker from France or Chablis or somewhere, you know, pick up the phone, I've got 14 people who have got a great network themselves if I don't have a network. So all that stuff benefits the customer.
And how did you think of doing that? Where did you get the idea to go, suppliers might have some cash?
Yeah, I picked up the phone to Rowan. Well, after my first few conversations with other investors, and he said, Eamon, you've worked for me for 10 years. I know you're craving that independence. So my first advice is don't take any money at all. But if you have to, take it from people who are going to be most aligned with you in the long term.
Love it. But isn't that the power of having people in your corner? Like, would you see him as kind of like a mentor?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, we catch up regularly. It goes both ways, you know. He was very good to me, taking me on, giving me a chance when no one else would have, but he put me in charge of his business, age 26, which not many people would do, but he must have liked something about my attitude and what I'd done already. I paid him back in spades, did a good job for him. So very healthy relationship that works both ways.
I like that, a peer network. It's not, you know, mentor to mentee. It's a peer network after a while.
Yeah, yeah. And I think mentoring is kind of tough in that, you know, if you just have a mentor or mentee and just catching it up every month or two on the phone or meeting for coffee, it's very hard to build that constant, that relationship, that trust. It's useful, but you cannot beat working with someone in the trenches over a long period of time. And you know, I would have those similar relationships with former colleagues as well, where I'd go to them for advice and vice versa. And it's just invaluable. So yeah,
brilliant. Eamon, we're going to do our quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
One book that I really enjoyed back in the day was Delivering Happiness by Tony Hsieh. Mm. He's the guy who founded Zappos.
Yes,
and again earlier on in my career. The importance of creating a strong company culture and that culture being centered around amazing customer service to people. I think it was hugely powerful. If you're in maybe a less consumer facing business, Good to Great by Jim Collins. It's just an amazing book. I think page per page, the value you get, you know, it's incredible. It talks about leadership, talks about, you know, conviction and, you know, the business model and, you know, hiring people, the right people before you figure out the right strategy. And it's all backed up by evidence. You know, a lot of business books are quite waffly and, you know, a bit padded out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good to Great. Just amazing stuff.
I think we've only had that once before. So that's, okay. I'll put that back on the top of the list. What's something you didn't pay attention to enough early on and had to learn the hard way?
I think cash flow, you know, going from running someone else's business to running your own business. If you screw up cash flow when you're an employee, you might lose your job, and that's bad, but it's just your job. If you screw up cash flow running your own company, you could lose your business. So you can never understand the stresses and pressure that, you know, keeping enough cash in the bank as a, you can only understand it as if it's your own business, your own livelihood. So that's definitely a learning, which I didn't understand earlier in my career, and I very much understand it now.
What's the one thing you've sacrificed for your success so far?
I'd say friendships. You know, in terms of like the hierarchy of like what's burning and what's kind of most, what's the highest priority at any given time. It's your children, followed by your business, followed by your family, and, you know, unfortunately friends, the good ones will always be there for you. But it's just I think a lot of entrepreneurs would say, you know, in those lonely times, you know, the friends kind of get sacrificed a little bit, and it just means, yeah, you figure out who your real friends are, and the ones that stick by you through it. But yeah, it's you do miss out on things for sure, and it is tough, but that's life.
I'm going to give you 10 million euros today. What are you going to do with it?
Well, I've always said if WineSpark is a success, how I know it'll be a success is I've dug a big hole under my house and built an amazing wine cellar. If we can fast forward that income, I'd do that. That wouldn't cost 10 million, but filling it with good wine might. So that's what I'd do.
It's the ultimate passion. That's probably the best answer we've had so far. What's something that's incredibly important to you in your daily routine?
I go to CrossFit most mornings. So I start the 6:15 class, start my day with that. And just getting the exercise done, over and done with nice and early. And, you know, a lot of my best thinking and ideas come when I'm stuck on the rower for 5 minutes with nothing else to do. I couldn't remove that from my life.
Same, exercise is fundamental, it's the core part of my day. If I give you 1 million euro today, how would you invest it?
I would probably invest it in some high-end wines from the likes of Burgundy and Bordeaux. So it's not my world in terms of what I kind of buy and sell right now, or drink, because I don't have the money for it. But, you know, throughout history, there will always be people willing to pay for them and overpay for them. Some of these chateaus and properties have hundreds of years of brand value behind them. So they're not going anywhere anytime soon. The only challenge potentially is, you know, if the world climate keeps going the way it is, some of these wines and wineries won't exist in 30, 40 years. It'll just be too hot, which will make them even more valuable than the wines that you buy now. That's probably what I'd do.
Good answer. If you had to start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
That's a tough question, because I am doing exactly what I love doing.
I thought that, yeah. I thought this would be, but we're going to put you in the spot. You have to start a brand new one. You have to leave wine behind.
Listen, I love writing still, and no matter what the topic. I see terrible writing everywhere in terms of, like, in marketing. Whether it's a copywriting agency or like a journalist or like a reporter or like a travel kind of reporter.
Something I could see you as a travel writer. I could see that.
Something about writing about nice stuff that makes people act on it.
What do you believe that other people would strongly disagree with or find strange?
I think you should always hire for attitude over experience. So you can teach experience. You can't teach attitude. So, you know, when you look at a CV, it'll only tell you so much, but it's when you're working with people, their attitude will shine through. And if they're good enough, they'll learn it and they'll get the experience pretty quick. So always favor attitude over experience.
This is probably the easiest question I'm going to give you all day. In your personal life, what's the one thing you spend money on that brings you a lot of happiness or joy?
Do you think I'm going to say wine?
Of course.
Well, thankfully, I don't have to spend much money on wine because it's always sent to me, but wine glasses.
Oh, good.
So,
okay.
Good wine glasses. You know, those really kind of brittle ones that you'd get in a nice restaurant. I think if you're drinking wine out of them, you'll get about 30% more enjoyment out of the wine.
Really?
The finer the glass, the more...
Go on, what's your wine? We'll go super niche here. This is going to appeal to 0.1% of the audience. What's your favorite wine glass?
Well, I think a lot of the audience will live near a nice wine shop.
Okay.
We don't stock wine glass ourselves, but like if you go down there and spend 30 or 40 quid on a glass, it sounds crazy, but from like a Zalto or a nice Riedel glass. And if you're buying nice wines anyway, you may as well enjoy them in nice glasses. So that's my one indulgence that I kind of enjoy. The other one is good coffee. Making nice coffee at home. I can't drink bad coffee. So
really, I'm with you on that one. Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I kind of have to add in an extra question here because I feel I should have asked it earlier. What's your favorite wine?
Very hard to answer that. I think it's like saying, what's my favorite child?
Give me a couple, top three even.
So you're heading to Spain on holidays. You'll be driving down through Burgos. Ribera del Duero, it's northern Spain. It's the wine is made from the Tempranillo grape. It's a really dark, rich, inky, kind of herbaceous flavors. Amazing with steak. There's this little lamb restaurant in a small town called Lerma. It's kind of halfway between San Sebastian and Madrid, a little medieval village in the middle of nowhere. We have a vineyard nearby that I've been visiting for years. And there's a little lamb restaurant in this village. It's called Casa Anton. And you walk in and it looks very unassuming, checkered tablecloths, some old fellows kind of sitting around the place, flies buzzing around. You sit down. And there's no menu, no kind of airs or graces about the place. And within about 5 minutes, a big tray of roast lamb. It's like plopped in front of you, crusty bread and a side of lettuce. And the lamb is called lechuza. It's 60 days old. only ever fed milk, slaughtered the day before you eat it, and roasted in its own juices for 5 or 6 hours over vine wood in these clay ovens. And the wine they bring out is this local dark-coloured rosé in goblet glasses from the local cooperative. And that wine, which on its own would taste rough as anything, but with that food in that setting, is the best wine you'll ever taste, right? And they're the sort of, it's like, you know, what's your favorite wine? It's like, what's the favorite?
Where am I? What am I doing? What am I eating?
Exactly.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that answer. So, what's your one final piece of advice to every entrepreneur or aspiring entrepreneur out there?
So my final piece of advice in three short words is go for no. So personally, as I said, I'm a bit of an introvert. I don't love pulling myself out there, but as an entrepreneur, you have to, you've no choice not to. I don't love dealing with rejection, all that stuff. I read a good book called Go For No recently, and I really changed my thinking around it. So rather than trying to maybe avoid those situations where you're going to get a no or going to get a rejection, actually, the more you put yourself out there and the more no's you get means you are putting yourself out there, and you are, and eventually one of those no's will turn into a yes. So, you know, if you're, you know, obviously there's nowhere to hide as an entrepreneur. There kind of can be in a bigger company where you can focus on your strengths and hide your weaknesses. It's a great mechanism to go, the more no's I'm getting in a week or a month, the actually more I'm putting myself out there. And it's just totally necessary. It's part of the game, starting your own business. So.
What a way to finish. I love that. I love that. We're quite similar. I'd be quite introverted as well. And I love that idea of just push the boundaries a little bit more and go for no. Eamon, that was a fantastic chat. Where can people learn more about WineSpark?
Head over to winespark.com. I'd love to have you as a member. And you can get me on LinkedIn, Eamon Fitzgerald, and we're on Instagram at WineSpark as well.
Eamon, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary.
That was my chat with Eamon Fitzgerald. Thank you very much for listening. Wherever you're listening, whether it's Apple, Spotify, or YouTube, click subscribe. It really helps the podcast to grow. I'll be back here in a couple of days with a brand new interview. I'll see you then.